Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home Puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time in the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Friday, June 4th, 2021. Headline in my beloved Bright One, the Chicago Sun-Times, home delivered every day. Independence Day comes a little early. Chicago to fully reopen with the rest of Illinois on June 11th as Lightfoot ditches July 4th date. We'll get into a little Lori Lightfoot stuff. Chicagoans love that powerful mayor. Just say, that's it. We're going back now. That's it. It's over. Pandemic's over. I'm the mayor. I'm more important than a pandemic. Anyway, with me to discuss this and all the news of the day, one of our most popular guests. Without further ado, I'll ask my distinguished most popular guest to introduce herself. Go ahead, popular guest.
Ramana Hussein. I'm an assistant metro editor at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And she's also a columnist. I always throw that in there. If I was the man ruling the world, she'd be a full-time columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. But I'm not the man ruling the world. I'm just a guy in front of a microphone in my attic overlooking an alley. All right, Ramana, so much to discuss. We spent like 45 minutes doing our pre-show planning and discussion. And I'm really looking forward to talking about this one. Naomi Osaka, the great tennis player, who pulled out of the French Open this week because she did not want to have to deal with the press on a daily basis. And I'm all over the map on this one, Ramana. On one hand, feel tremendous amount of sympathy toward her. And I have my own issues with the press that I'm kind of working out. At the same time, everybody's always beating up the press. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, I feel like I can beat up the press because I'm part of the press. Then, you know, it's just like coming off of fake news and Trump. I'm just a little hesitant to join the fray. Your thoughts on all this? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I have the same kind of thoughts you do. You know, journalists always want to talk to their sources or they want to talk to the people who are involved in the stories that they're writing. So I can understand that, you know, sports reporters want to talk to the subjects that are involved in these competitions, that are involved in these games. I totally understand that. But I also sympathize with Naomi Osaka as well. If those of our listeners might not have known, is that she withdrew from playing in the French Open. I don't know anything about tennis. I know very little about tennis, I should tell you. I once in a while, if there's a really famous player, but I do know not who Naomi Osaka is. I know who Serena and Venus Williams are. You know, John McEnroe, like whenever Billie Jean King, whenever there's like a big tennis player, I do know who they are. But I don't follow tennis. But so I knew her pulling out of the U.S. French Open was a big deal. And then I read about it. It was because, you know, she had pulled out a day after that she was fined and threatened with more sanctions for not speaking to the press. And she, you know, she talked a little, she had a post on social media talking about how she suffers from anxiety and that she's not very good at public speaking and how, you know, dealing with the press is really hard for her. So I did have sympathy on that end. And I do think that reporters don't necessarily always get it right. And I'm someone from the press. I get very defensive when I'm with a group of my friends who aren't journalists and they start saying stuff about the press. And I don't agree with them sometimes. So then I'm like defending myself. And, you know, my friends who aren't journalists usually make fun of me because they say I get really defensive. But I said that, you know, our profession is one of those professions where everybody thinks it's okay to rip on. I think the left and the right are both guilty politically. And I have friends who tend to be on the left and they don't like the media as much as the people on the right, but they don't believe in fake. They don't use the word fake news, but they do think the media is wrong in a lot of instances. And so, you know, I'm critical of the media too. I think most people in the press, a lot of people in the press who work in the press are critical of the media too. So I don't know. In general, I had sympathy for Naomi Osaka. I don't know how the specific reporters had dealt with her, but I do know that reporters can be, not all reporters, but reporters can be a little aggressive sometimes. And I don't know. I don't know if this thinking is very common with the millennials, but it certainly was with the older generation, where they thought that being a jerk made you a better journalist. When I started in journalism in the 90s, there were obviously a lot of boomers still in the business. And I would hear them talking about stuff that happened in the past. And, you know, some of them would just laugh about it. It was like crazy, like sexist stuff. You know, someone who was an alcoholic was revered. You know, they talk about how people had like alcohol in their cabinets and that's all journalists did all day. And, you know, being gruff was like, you know, it's like if you didn't fit that stereotype, we weren't a good journalist. So I kind of felt like for a long time, like being gruff and being like a bumbling alcoholic and, you know, being sexist was like, that was like a good journalist. And a lot of like people from my generation would think, I knew people who were like, you know, they tried to emulate that and they thought that being a jerk made you a better journalist. And that's not necessarily true. A couple of years ago, I usually don't complain about my colleagues, but I had complained about a colleague that was very rude. I'm not going to say anybody's name, but my boss basically told me, oh, you know, he's just a lovable curmudgeon. And I was just like, why? And then I told another friend about it, another colleague, and they're like, you know, it's not the 1940s or 1950s where being a, can I swear, where being a a-hole is makes you a better journalist. And I think a lot of older generation people think that. And there are some people in the younger generation too who think that. They think like being edgy and being like, oh, I'm too cool for anything, like makes you a good journalist, like not having any sort of empathy. And I think that's one of the, I personally think that if you have the more empathy you have, the better journalist you are, because a lot of the best journalists I've seen, at least people who I think are really good journalists, are people who really try to understand other individuals. So for me, it's a little complex. I understand Naomi Osaka's position, and I don't blame her for not wanting to play. And I do think that when she says that she suffers from anxiety, you know, I have sympathy for her because it probably is hard. Like, I'm someone who likes to talk. So for me, like, that's very hard. Like, oh, you know, it's hard. But then, you know, I don't understand how it would be hard for people to talk. But, you know, I have to understand that not everybody's like me and not everybody wants to talk. And it's hard for people. And just because someone's famous and is an athlete doesn't mean that they want to go in front of the press every day in front of a bunch of microphones and talk to people.
Well, and just it's beyond talking. So it's the specific topics that they ask you about. So for instance, in sports, and there's some parallels to popular culture and movies and entertainment, et cetera, but definitely in sports, since the event itself is widely watched by everybody and immediately available to be seen again and again on the internet, so much of sports journalism has come down to sort of like gotcha moments. So when a Naomi Osaka comes before the press, just like when LeBron James, like last night, the Lakers lost to the Suns. So when LeBron James sits down, they're not just going to ask you, oh, LeBron, what's your feelings about Joe Biden's infrastructure plan? They're going to say, well, LeBron, you were devastated. You lost by 20 points. Does this suggest that you are over the hill and washed up? Just think about that. At this moment of vulnerability, when you're feeling really bad about having lost a game, there's going to be the horde of these reporters going, come on, you suck. What about your teammates who choked LeBron, huh? You know what I mean? So they're not just asking you questions. They're looking for your most vulnerable spots, and then they're poking a stick at them. And Chicago reporters are kind of saying, we've watched this give and take with Lori Lightfoot. Remember when Lori Lightfoot, the reporters, it looked like she was criticizing Kim Fox. And so the reporters are going, are you criticizing your old friend, Kim Fox? And then Lori Lightfoot gave it right back. Don't tell me what I'm doing, you troublemakers. So there is that. And my attitude is those are the questions that have to be asked, as difficult as they are to answer. And if you're a professional athlete, you got to deal with it. That's just the terms of the game. That's kind of how I view it. Your thoughts on that?
No, and I have to admit, like, I'm not like you where I watch sports that intensely, like you or my husband or my brother. Like, I watch sports, but I don't really follow the media. I don't read news stories about, I don't read the sports section. I should tell you that much. But I do know that sports reporters and, you know, all reporters, we have to be aggressive. I'm not going to say that we're not supposed to be aggressive or ask the hard questions. We're not supposed to be asking softball questions. You know, our best political reporters ask the tough questions with politicians. So I guess sports reporters feel like they have to ask tough questions as well. And like I said, I'm not someone that follows sports, but my stereotype, and I'm probably wrong with all my stereotypes of sports reporters, is that they sit around and they scream a lot, because my brother used to watch a lot of sports channels when I was, we're all under my parents' roof, and he would watch sports TV constantly. You know, we'd be in the car and he'd turn on sports radio, and, you know, they're all like kind of, it's kind of like over the top, kind of like this over, you know, macho, like discussions. And, you know, and I always felt like, you know, the jerkier you are in sports, reporting, the better you were considered. And, you know, there's a lot, I mean, I think it's kind of changed. I think sports reporting, I follow some female sports reporters, and it's totally changed. And I don't know if it's because there's more women in sports, but there's a lot of women who cover sports now too. And they're just as passionate as the, you know, male reporters. And I think they've kind of changed the game a little, and maybe it's generational. I feel like it's changed a little, like, there's more people of color, there's more women. And I feel like it's changed.
Well, I got to tell you this as a sports junkie. And by the way, I love how you added to the list of people get thrown under the bus. Usually it's just her husband, Mick Dumke. Every now and then I get thrown under the bus. Now her poor brother gets thrown under the bus too. By the way, eye doctor, as I recall, pound for pound, the funniest doctor I've ever seen. His toast at Ramona's wedding is still, every now and then I think about him. He threw the entire, you got to, folks, this is just a tangent within a tangent. A huge banquet hall, I think in Lincolnwood. Maybe Skokie. I don't know. It's that part of Lincolnwood, Skokie, where they border each. Okay, Skokie. I always get them mixed up. Anyway, huge banquet hall. Lots of journalists in this room. Okay, because Ramona and Mick are journalists. The dude threw the whole freaking press corps under the bus, drove the bus back over the carcass. I got to give him credit, man. He's a funny guy. Anyway, I'm telling you, where they're at in sports right now, is people yelling at each other. You had it right. I mean, they're not nice. They're not gentle. The millennials are doing this too. It's like a body is thrown out in front of two dueling combatants, and then they rip the body apart in shreds and talk about its innards, and then they start yelling at each other and insulting each other. There's right now, I neglected to send this to you, a feud between Kwame Brown, a former NBA basketball player, and Stephen A. Smith, who's perhaps the most prominent sports personality on TV. And they're going at it, Ramona. You would be all over this if you discovered it. You know what I mean? They're going at it. It's mad at each other. And a lot of it's just so over the top. This is where we're at right now in journalism. And again, I'll say this. It's not just sports. I listened to the coverage of the red carpet at the Oscars, and they are shredding these women. You call that a dress? She looks like a gorilla in that thing. I mean, God damn, so it's not just sports. I think this is where we're at as a society.
And one of the things I should note about these award shows is men never get asked what they're wearing. They get asked about their body of work, and then the women come. And, you know, of course, they're expected to, you know, wear a designer gown, but they're always just asked, like, no, what are you wearing? And where are your diamonds from? And so, yeah, the questioning is very, very sexist as well. And, yeah, I'm not going to lie. I have watched some of those shows where they pick apart, like, people's outfits when they're wearing something that's non-traditional. And I'm not going to say that I didn't take delight in it, because sometimes it is fun to see who's the worst, quote unquote, worst dressed or best dressed. But yeah, you know, at the end of the day, you know, just because someone's a celebrity or an athlete, they are human beings. I think that's one thing that people tend to forget. I mean, Mick was pointing out to me that recently they were throwing bottles at NBA players. And it was kind of driven. It was kind of very, I guess the players felt like it said that it was racist, and it probably was. I'm not denying what they said. And I was telling him, I'm like, you know, at the end of the day, people think that just because someone's an athlete and is making like multi-million dollar salary, that they're not human beings, and people don't treat them with respect. And, you know, we've seen this over and over again. A lot of people feel like athletes should just play and not say anything or not have any feelings. And that's not true. At the end of the day, they're people. And that's why I say it's important to have empathy for someone. And I'm not saying that doesn't mean you can't ask them tough questions. You know, I'm not saying that, oh, you know, don't ask Lori Lightfoot anything, you know, just be nice to her. You have to ask tough questions, but there's a way of doing it. And there's a proper way of doing it. And there's like a wrong way of doing it.
Yeah. The bottle that, Romano's alluding to was thrown by a fan of the Boston Celtics at Kyrie Irving, who used to play for the Celtics. Now he plays for the Nets. Popcorn was thrown on Russell Westbrook. John Morant's parents were subjected to racist taunting in Utah. The list goes on and on. I think with people returning to NBA arenas, just a lot of MAGA poison has seeped into the culture of sports. And I appreciate that the NBA has they're just not tolerating it, because it's just completely unacceptable, in my humble opinion. All right, let's move on from Naomi Osaka and the press. Although I have to say that, wait, before I lose. This is one of my favorite little riffs I'll share with you. Every movie or TV show I see where reporters are assembled, they always look like an unruly mob of like locusts. I just saw this in Mayor of Easttown, some schlumpy town in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. The press corps, when Mayor comes out of the car, Mayor, did you kill him? It's just like, I'm like, God damn, man.
There was more people in the press in Mayor from Easttown than there was in the town itself. Mick was saying, how do they get so many people from the press? Like, do they have that many media outlets in that small town?
I know. Yeah, no, they love doing that scene where somebody gets out of a car and there's just a horde of angry, nasty, heartless reporters screaming questions out. It's like, come on, Hollywood, give us a break, man. You always make the reporters look bad in every single movie. They're always the ones all crowd them. Anyway, I had to get that off my chest. All right, let's move on. And I'm going to bring up the subject. You sent me a very funny text. It had me laughing out loud. So I did the story in the Reader, column in the Reader, where I took my beloved lefties to task for pretending that anti-Jewishness does not exist in the world. And I don't know, I never heard of that before. Yeah, duh. And so in passing, I noted that just from my experience, just as a guy walking through life, that the group, I was talking about like gross generalizations about a group where you take like something one person does and turn it into the entire like action of all groups. So like Ramana's on classic one is Ramana talks about a Muslim who does act of terror all Muslims are doing acts of terror. So I said the group that is the most vilified in this way are Black Americans, followed by Jews, and then Muslims. This was like one sentence in this longer. Ramana, boom. Muslims are number two. Jews are three. Let's have a big debate on this one, Ramana. Who's more hated in this country by the most Americans, Jews or Muslims? Go.
Oh, Muslims for sure. I know you're going to say there's anti-Semitism, and I'm not going to say, you know, I'm not someone who is like, oh, no, there's no anti-Semitism. But Islamophobia is treated like, at least people, when it comes to anti-Semitism, we know what the, you know, the microaggressions are, what things are said about Jewish people, like what things are said about Muslim people. Like, people don't even know that it's offensive. They'll like say things, and, you know, at least there are movies about anti-Semitism. There's no movies about Islamophobia. It's kind of considered, you know, that's just part of culture. Like, if Barack Obama was Jewish, I'm not saying that if Barack Obama had like Jewish fathers, like if he had like a Jewish father and a Jewish stepfather, I don't think he would have to go to the lengths, you know, that Barack Obama had to do, where he's like, I'm not a Muslim, don't worry, I'm not a Muslim. You know, it was just like, oh, you know, I'm Christian, you know, I love Jesus. And by the way, Muslims love Jesus too. But it's like I felt like he had to go out of the way to prove that he wasn't Muslim. I think there would be enough of an outcry if he was, you know, embarrassed to be like, you know, from a Jewish background, or not embarrassed, but it would have to feel like he'd have to hide it to be politically viable. So I don't know. And you probably, when I read your column, it was pretty interesting when you talked about how when you're in a group of people and, you know, people probably don't know that you're Jewish, and they'll blurt out something about being a Jewish person. And I can understand that, because when I go to India, that happens to me. Like, if I'm with a group of people, especially if they're educated, they don't think a Muslim can be that educated. Some people have that stereotype. So I could be in a group of people, I don't say my name, and then all of a sudden someone will say something really Islamophobic. That's happened to me in India. And then I have to say something, you know, I feel like my face getting red, and then I'm like, hello, I'm Muslim. So I do understand, and I do sympathize with, you know, Jewish Americans, but I still think I'm not playing the, you know, game who gets treated worse. But I do think that, you know, Muslims are kind of vilified more than I think Jewish people as a whole.
The larger point I was making is that we are exposed. I'm not the only one. We're exposed to like prejudice and bigotry all the time. Absolutely all the time. You cannot go through your rounds of your daily life really without hearing some kind of bigoted remark. And sometimes it's directed at Black people, and sometimes it's like misogynistic, directed at women, sometimes it's directed at Jews, etc. and so forth. And it's just something that we absorb. And I'm just thinking about myself, just like in the course of my day. And, you know, every time you hear a bigoted remark, what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to just ignore it, just walk away, make a joke about it, or challenge the person? You know, if you're challenging a person and you're in a bar and they're drunk, maybe that's not the best idea, because then it gets belligerent. I've gone both ways with this. I've challenged, and then that really turned nasty. I've walked away. I just walked away from one the other day, not too long ago, a bigoted remark about Jews. And I don't think the guy even thought he was making a joke. And so my larger point was for the left, when it comes to dealing with attitudes toward Israel, to think that there's no anti-Jewish sentiment that somehow or other creeps in, to act like that, just that very suggestion is outrageous. And I'm like, what world do you live in? Like, how could you not reflect on what you probably heard at your Thanksgiving table from some drunken uncle last year? And that was the point I was making. And I hear it, but you're absolutely correct. It's like, you're right. You may be right that actually people feel more free to rip Muslims, but it's but maybe what I was saying is that there's not as many like open Muslims at the bowling alley where I go to, so that they're not going to say it directly to them. Do you get what I'm saying? So anyway, that's the point I was making in the course of a day or life.
Yeah. And you probably hear it because you're Jewish and I hear it because I'm Muslim, right? Like sometimes, well, people will make jokes and then, you know, they'll be like, ah, you know, and then, you know, they'll say things like, well, you're not like the other Muslims, or you're like a cool Muslim. And so like, what is that supposed to mean? Like, as opposed to a normal Muslim, you know? So it's like, it is offensive. And I have friends who are practicing, you know, on different levels. And like, even my friends who aren't even that practicing, like, you know, they get really upset when they hear something Islamophobic. And it's hard. It's because it's like, we've been vilified. You know, I grew up, I was born in the early 70s. Nobody knew who Indian people were. So nobody knew, you know, when the first time most Americans and from my generation heard of Muslims was at the Iran hostage situation. Then they were confused, like why I was brown and not Iranian. And it's like, there was so much confusion about who I was. And 9/11 made things different in the sense that, you know, the vilification just kind of went from there. So I don't know. I think it's interesting that you mentioned Israel and Palestine and how, you know, the anti-Semitism. And I think differently where people, it's like for the longest time, people couldn't say anything pro-Palestinian because then you were considered anti-Semitic if you said anything against Israel. So I think for the first time in a long time, people are saying things like, hey, you can criticize Israel, but you don't have to be anti-Semitic about it. Of course, it doesn't mean you're anti-Semitic. So
I'm with you on that one. And it's a really tricky thing because someone wants to make a legitimate criticism of Israel bombing Gaza, which, I mean, I'm just, we don't usually talk about international politics on the show, but when I'm looking at just by reading the newspaper, I see in Israel, they're moving Netanyahu out, or they're threatening, or they're hoping, or God, that's a crazy democracy they have there. But the point is, I think everybody has come to the conclusion, whether they'll state it openly or not, that Netanyahu ginned up that last conflict in a Trump-like move to keep himself in office, in power, so he would not be prosecuted. That's my personal belief, just based on what I read in the newspaper. So how could you in any way justify his reign? I completely agree with my leftist brothers and sisters when they criticize Israel. Again, the point that where they go and take that is that next step, and they go that, yo, there's no anti-Semitism among our ranks. I'm like, come on. Look, just anyway, I make my point pretty much all the time on the show on that one. I like to give my lefty.
I think lefties can be Islamophobic too. So, and they don't know it. That's the thing. Well, like you were saying, I don't think they think certain things are offensive. And that's how we're talking about the Salman Rushdie thing.
Whoa.
And, you know, saying things like, you know.
So talk, well, okay, I think you.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, I was just saying that people don't really know Muslims well enough to know what's offensive and what isn't. And so it's just like everything, you know, the people say things left and right and they don't realize what they're saying is offensive, or it's okay to be offensive to Muslims because we don't know what we're talking about. We're uncivilized and terrorists. So, you know, when you get painted those words, it's just easier for people to dehumanize you, I guess.
Very good. All right, let's move on from this debate, which I'm sure we'll do a ranking as the months goes on. Who's more disliked in the United States of America, Muslims or Jews?
But I do agree with you that African Americans have it the hardest. I will agree.
Oh my God, it's like yeah. And I feel compelled just to point the obvious out. You know what I'm saying? And I know you feel the same way, Romana. But yeah, come on, guys. This is. Let's be clear about our whole history here, which folks try to ignore as much as they can. All right, let's move on to some local news. Lori Lightfoot, Mayor Lori Lightfoot, is now 2 years in. And they just had a poll the other day that came out. I don't know if you saw it, but roughly 48%, close to 50% of Chicagoans that were surveyed in this poll think she's doing a good job. And another high percentage of them think she's honest and truthful. I can't even say these things without laughing. I apologize, Romana. I personal opinion is that she's an improvement over Rahm Emanuel and Richard M. Daley. But in my humble opinion, that bar is awfully low, so I'm really not saying much. That's like saying someone's a better dancer than me. I'm a terrible dancer. So I express myself a lot on Lori Lightfoot. Your thoughts on the job Lori Lightfoot has done and her popularity with Chicagoans?
I thought her popularity would be less than 50%, but I guess 50% isn't that great. I don't know. I think it's a hard job. I'm not going to say that it's an easy job to be the mayor of Chicago, and especially during the pandemic, but there are a lot of things that she promised, including, you know, the civilian police board, the elected school board, which, by the way, this, you know, the state legislature just, you know, passed over the last week. Just, I don't know. I think a lot of people are disappointed in her from what I've seen. She seems to have, she seems to get very sensitive to any sort of tough questions and seems to not take criticism very easily. And I think as a leader, you have to learn how to do that and just kind of learn to work around that. So I don't know. I thought it would be a little less than that, but I guess 50% isn't that great either. But yeah, I think people might think that she's a slight improvement from Rahm, but a lot of people, what I hear is they think that she's just like Rahm.
Well, I can tell you right now, she's not just like Rahm. I'm a Rahmologist, having studied Rahm, and a little bit of a Lightfootologist. I don't haven't had much time to study Lori Lightfoot as I did to Rahm, but I don't believe she's just like Rahm at all. Their worldview is similar, how they run the city, and they're centrist Democrats. I mean, that's what they are, and so they're very protective of what the well-to-do in the city, you know, and they want to make sure that Chicago continues to quote unquote grow in that area. And of secondary importance is, in my humble opinion, what happens in poor neighborhoods. I guess there are some parallels there, but I just feel like in temperament, they're different. And just the way they go about their jobs, I think they're different. So I don't know. I think it's just a slight improvement over Rahm. But these hacked emails that we've been talking a lot about on the show, and we had Tommy Schubert from the Sun-Times on to take a victory lap because he's done a lot of great reporting based on the hacked emails, which you probably edited those stories, reveal a side of Lori Lightfoot that, you know, is a little off-putting, and that is the side where behind the scenes, they talk one way, and then publicly they talk another way. And then generally when I say, point this out, the instinctive reaction of Chicagoans is, well, Ben, that's just how politicians are. They're deceitful. And so I just feel as though, Ramona, really, that's Chicago. The mentality of Chicago is you just tolerate corruption. You just tolerate deceit. You tolerate arrogance. You tolerate bullies. And the response is always the same. Well, that's how everyone is, Ben. So what are we? Okay. So is that it? We just raised the white flag. Everybody's going to be deceitful. Everyone's going to be a bully. Everyone's going to be arrogant. I don't know. I struggle with this, Ramona. Your thoughts?
No, I agree. I agree. I agree 100% with what you're saying. I do think the criticism is warranted against Lightfoot. I don't think she gets a pass, but I do think that a lot of people thought it would be a lot different with her in power. They saw her as a progressive, and a lot of people point out that she never was a progressive, but they saw her running on this progressive platform and they had expected more.
Yeah. Well, now we're being told, oh, that's just promises the politicians make. So just, she's going to break them because that's what politicians do. And then life goes on and 50% of the people see Chicago say, okay, so it makes sense to me. All right. You sent me a text. You gave me a homework for a change, and you introduced me to a congressman named Ted Lieu, who has some interesting attitudes about how we distribute vaccine. Let's talk a little bit about that. Go ahead.
Okay. So Ted Lieu, I think he's this, let me make sure I'm identifying him correctly to you. He is I believe he's a member of Congress, and he's from California, and he tends to be very left. But yesterday he had a tweet about the global vaccines, then the distribution, and said that he basically insinuated that it should be based on, should be distributed based on whoever our allies are. And he just said he disagreed with, others, handling the passing out of the vaccines. And he said that, this is what his tweet said. He said, "I strongly disagree with the Biden administration on their global vaccine rollout. We should help our allies first instead of letting a third party decide where the vaccines should go. Since there are not enough vaccines, should we help India or Iran? We should help India first." And I don't know, I had to respond to the tweet, and I kind of quote tweeted him, and I said, "Never understood the American need to shade everyday Iranians over and over again." And I feel like this is, going back to what the Islamophobia we're talking about. It's like so easy to vilify a nation because based on their government. And India, if anybody follows India, I'm of Indian descent. My parents are from India. And India's government has been very Islamophobic. So just because they're allies doesn't mean that they're like the best, example of, the best example of the governments in the world. Like Saudi Arabia is an ally too. They kill, the leaders there killed a journalist there. So, it's like this attitude, like just because we don't like the government or they're not quote unquote our friends, the people aren't deserving of vaccines. I mean, people can look at our country and look at our government and the things that our government has done and think that we're not deserving of a lot of things either. And there are a lot of people who support Trump. So are you saying that they're not deserving of the vaccine? I mean, this is a health crisis. And if we're not all getting the vaccines, it can affect all of us detrimentally. It doesn't matter if they're Iranian or if they're Indian. Everybody needs a vaccine. So I don't know. I was personally kind of offended by that kind of attitude by someone who espouses to be someone on the left. And, he is usually, I probably agree with his politics more than I don't, but I saw that tweet and it just kind of touched a nerve in me.
Well, I would just, as I always do at this moment, point out that he's more a liberal than a leftist.
Yeah. He's not a member of the squad, I guess.
Yeah, he's not a squad. Right. He's not a squadron member. And he's not a Bernie Sanders socialist. He is your classic Democratic left liberal, which is a distinction that I like to uphold. Yeah, no, I thought it was, I'm with you. I at some point, can we just put the politics aside and treat, a health crisis as a health crisis that affects people? You're right. And your point is so well taken. Like blaming Iranians for their government, blaming someone in India for the politics of their government, blaming anybody in a country, that's like blaming you or me for what Trump did.
Exactly.
We didn't vote for him. I spoke out against him, but in a way, I kind of am. As a member of this country, we had this horrific nationalist, white supremacist, wacko running our country, grifter. And so that's, I mean, am I responsible for that? I don't know. Is some ordinary guy in Tehran responsible for what his country does? I don't think so. So I disagree with the liberal congressman from California. And sometimes when I see liberals and Dems, it's like they're, Biden used to do this. They're bending over backward to like show they're tough too. You know what I'm saying? Like they got a little MAGA in them as well. And I don't buy into that at all. All right, Nate, let's close with Romana's recommendations. And what are you going to recommend today, Romana?
Well, I finished Mayor of Easttown. I know we're going to talk a little bit about that. And I did your homework, and I did watch the Tina Turner documentary on Netflix last week, and I did like it. Well, I was reading about this show. It's about a punk rock band that consists of Muslim women. It was made in England. It's on the Peacock Network. So I had a trial for the Peacock Network to watch the John Gacy documentary, which is made by a former colleague of yours. And now I'll probably have to do some sort of trial, or I'll tell Mick to get a trial for this Peacock channel to watch the show. The show is called We Are Lady Parts. And I also saw the trailer for Anthony Bourdain's movie. It's, you know, Anthony Bourdain sadly had taken his own life a couple years ago, maybe 3 years ago. I was a huge fan of Anthony Bourdain because I love traveling overseas, and he had a great, you know, his travel series were always so awesome and really cool. And we're just talking about Iran. He would go to different countries that most Americans would never go to because they've been vilified by our government. And he would really do a good job in humanizing, you know, individuals. And he did a better job than most other people could do. And a lot of people from these cultures would say that, you know, he was very respectful of other people's cultures. And he was like kind of like this cool New Yorker. And he would, you know, he was very brash, but he was also very warm. And so I've always been a huge fan of Anthony Bourdain. And so there's this movie about his life. It's called Roadrunner. And it's like a film about him and his life. So that's coming out in July. But they had a trailer yesterday that came out. So those are two things I'm looking forward to watching. I don't know. What do you think I should watch? What are your assignments?
Wait, time out. So is that a documentary?
It's a documentary, but it's going to be coming out, I think, on HBO Max and maybe in theaters. So you can watch it in the theater too if you want to. Ben.
Okay. I have a confession to make. I am utterly obsessed, as I believe your husband is, with NBA playoffs.
Oh yeah.
And the TV every night has been tuned to basketball. I watch, this is a little embarrassing to reveal, up to 3 hours of basketball will be on, maybe 2.5 hours. Like last night, I watched the Lakers-Suns game and a portion of the game that preceded it, the Trailblazers versus the Nuggets. So I'm not watching any TV shows. I haven't watched a movie. I'm starting to wonder maybe I need help. Because I've been really watching a lot of basketball and enjoying it. So I've been really falling down on the recommending shows.
Yeah, Mick has too.
Yeah, I know. Because whenever I text him, he's watching the same exact thing.
Yeah, he's eating dinner in front of the TV and I'm eating dinner at the kitchen table. And he asked me if I mind. And I'm like, that's fine. I'll do my own thing and text my friends while you're sitting there watching the game. And, you know, he makes commentary. And I'm like, I have no interest. But yeah, I'm sure I like basketball, but I'm not someone who watches it.
Well, maybe you'll start paying attention when it gets to the, like, finals. And this is, we're like only in the first round. But I did watch Mayor of Easttown. I have to say that I thought it was a really stupid show, but I was utterly obsessed with it and enjoyed the ride. And it's just sort of my attitude about TV shows in general. More often than not, Ramona, they're not worth all the time we spend watching them. But the high of watching them and the moment of watching is, it's just a nice, enjoyable moment and diversion from everything. So it's worth it. And then when it's all over, I go, why did I do that? Why did I watch? So, and I got to get a shout out to Kate Winslet. Even though I'm a Donald Trump-like generally in my attitudes about Brits getting all the roles, she did a great job in that show. So there you go.
Yeah, I think if it was in lesser, if it was an actress that wasn't as good as Kate Winslet, and I thought the actors in general, all the people playing off against her were really great too. So I don't think, I think if there was a lesser actress in Kate Winslet, I think even though we said the show was kind of ridiculous and you saw the ending, I said that no way a 13-year-old kid can pull a body. I don't know. Maybe there's some strong 13-year-old kids. There are some things that kind of, you know, I was like, no way, that never would happen. But I do think the acting really helped the show, and I enjoyed it. There's actually talk about, people loved it so much that there's talk that there's gonna, you know, they weren't planning on doing a second season, but it was so successful that there may be a second season.
Mayor too. Let me just say that. Here's the other thing. When you really closely watch one of these shows, and you put your full powers of critical thinking, which you very rarely use on stuff that really matters, like, I don't know, public policy, but you put it on a TV show, you really see the flaws in the logic and the plotting. And in Mayortown, I keep calling it Mayortown because I just take the mayor and the town and put it together. So in Mayor of Easttown, there were like two giant flaws And you already gave away the ending in a way.
Oh, sorry for anybody who hasn't watched it.
See, yeah.
But I think everybody has at this point who is watching it.
Yeah, at this point. But like the whole thing about the gun is so ridiculous. So the big piece of evidence that investigator gets is when this older fellow tells her that he discovered his gun was missing. And then from that, she figures out who did the murder by looking at a video of the shed where the gun was taken. And she sees the person who took the gun and she goes, that's who did the murder. Okay. So that's the big aha moment. Well, it turns out the gun was only missing for like 2 hours from that shed that the person took the gun, did the dirty deed, brought the gun back. How did that old geezer get up in the middle of the night, go out to the shed, and see the missing gun? My wife and I are like, hey, man, that is a flaw.
That's a definitely good catch, because I didn't even think about that. I thought it took like a day before it, but I was like, why would you, even like noticing the gun, why would you notice that like in that 2 hours? Like, you're right. Like, why would you, why was that something you notice unless you sit there and take the gun out every like couple hours and cradle in your hands?
Yeah. So generally when I raise subjects like that, it's not dissimilar to the reaction people give me when I point out like our mayor is a bully and she doesn't tell the truth. They go, everyone's like that. So when you raise an objection to a plot in a movie, they go, Ben, it's just a movie. Okay. All right. Whatever. Can't win any way you look at it. All right, Ramon, I want to thank you very much for taking time out, and we'll talk to you real soon. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for having me again.
All right. That's the great Ramon Hussein. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.